See, it was a human collaborator. Scouts, probably. Thoughts of his father, of his captivity in Mount Katahdin, and of the destruction of his former home in Maine flooded his mind. He wanted to tear apart every last one of these evil men, but the wooden beads of the bracelet Tasha had given him bumped against his wrist, reminding him he had more to live for than revenge. Even if he and Horn were better shots, the collaborators might already be sending people to surround them. The two of them couldn't hold out forever. More importantly, they had a bigger mission at stake.
"Cover me, and I'll get the anthrax," Timothy said.
Horn gave him a nod before unleashing a hail of bullets. Return fire speared into the cars as Timothy sprinted away. More bullets seared through the air past him. A couple sparked against the wet asphalt. He slid next to Boyd and hid behind the first variant he had killed as rounds thumped into both corpses. Timothy reached over and searched Boyd's pockets for the syringe of anthrax. Boyd's throat was torn open, and his eyes were locked open in a look of horror.
"I'm sorry," Timothy said.
More bullets slammed into the variant and Boyd, forcing Timothy to draw his hand back. He waited a moment, then tried a new pocket, and found the plastic syringe.
"Got it!"
Timothy yelled. He stashed it in his vest and drew himself up into a low firing position, providing cover for Horn. The big man raked the M249 back and forth, then took off running. Shouts from the collaborators carried over the rain as Timothy retreated to the backyard of the closest house. Horn was huffing and puffing, but managed to keep running toward the golf course bordering the backyards. They didn't slow until they found cover in a tree line, and even then, they pushed themselves forward, never completely stopping until they reached the edge of the webbing-covered tunnel. Water ran over the sides and down into it, turning it into a muddy mess.
"I'll cover you," Horn heaved.
He aimed back the way they had come. The ground seemed to rumble, but this wasn't thunder. The monsters in the tunnel were close. With the anthrax in one hand, Timothy dropped to his belly, still gasping to catch his breath. He lay flat and stretched to reach one of the tendrils within the tunnel. With a jab, he got the needle into the throbbing red vine and depressed the plunger. A howl erupted from deeper inside the tunnel. The stench of rotten fruits filled his lungs. His body shook as the walls trembled more fiercely. The click of joints and growls of bloodthirsty monsters echoed toward him.
"Hurry up,"
Horn said. Timothy backed out and began to stand, but Horn yanked him down in the cover of the tall grass.
"We got more company," Horn said. "Collaborators caught up to us."
"Can't stay here. The variants aren't far behind."
"I fucking hate running," Horn said.
He stood, ready to move.
"Don't leave me behind, kid. I still haven't given you permission to date my daughter."
Timothy almost laughed, but a burst of gunfire made him flinch. Another terrifying tremor rumbled the ground, the shaking more violent. Another spot of grass 20 yards to their west pushed upward. A familiar, terrifying, clicking shriek sounded from the newly formed hole as Timothy took off running with Horn. They both watched the ground burst upward in a geyser of wet soil and long grass. An alpha pulled itself out, and variants poured out after it.
"Faster!"
Horn yelled. Timothy had never run harder in his life. He pushed himself to his physical limit, his lungs burning with the effort. Horn was starting to fall behind. Timothy eased up and took a moment to look at their pursuers. Monsters galloped over the wet ground, tearing through the grass, and gunfire flashed from the golf course.
"Keep running!"
Horn yelled. Timothy took off again. Images of Tasha flashed through his mind. She was waiting for him back in Galveston. If he didn't make it back, he wouldn't see her again. He wouldn't be able to help her from the incoming army of monsters descending on their base, and if he didn't save her dad, they would both be screwed. He skidded to a stop and aimed to take out the closest variants, buying the big man some extra time. The creatures bolted into the fire, not even trying to avoid the bullets. Horn stopped to send a burst of rounds into the enemy's ranks, taking down two of the lead beasts, but the Alpha never stopped.
"Come on!"
Horn yelled. They reached the street where they had left the Humvee, and Timothy spotted the truck. By the time they made it there, the Alpha was halfway down the street with a pack of variants flocking around it. Horn opened the driver's door as Timothy dove into the back seat. He didn't even have time to shut the door before Horn pushed down on the pedal. The vehicle lurched forward, but then jolted to a stop. Timothy looked back to see the Alpha had grabbed the back bumper, water sluicing over its diseased flesh.
"Come on, baby," Horn said.
The Humvee growled, tires squealing. Timothy pulled out his pistol and fired at the back windshield. Glass burst outward and bullets punched into the meaty flesh. The Alpha held on until a couple rounds smashed through its snout. The vehicle tore away, ripping out one of the Alpha's claws. The beast ran after them with the entourage of smaller monsters and the collaborators, bullets slamming against the back of the Humvee. Horn navigated out of the neighborhood and onto the highway, leaving their pursuers behind, never letting up on the gas.
"Jesus Christ in heaven," Horn said. "We clear?"
"I think so," Timothy said, still gasping. "So, does this mean I got permission to date Tasha?"
"We'll see," Horn said.
Water fell in sheets over the windshield, the wipers switching back and forth. Horn dodged past a wrecked vehicle, and Timothy climbed into the front passenger seat. He picked up his radio.
"Command, Recon Sigma 1. We got the anthrax injected. Headed back to base now."
"Copy that," the comms officer replied. "Good work, Recon Sigma 1. What's your ETA?"
50 minutes if we press it."
"Better hurry up or you'll be cut off," the comms officer said.
"Copy," Horn said.
He slammed the radio down.
"Cut off?" Timothy asked.
"The bridge," Horn said. "They're gonna blow it."
"If they do, we're stuck on this side of the bay with all those monsters."
"My girls are on that island, Temper. You sure as shit know I am not letting us stay on this side of the bay while those beasts try to take Galveston."
Timothy checked to make sure his belt was secure.
"Yeah. Better hold on to your ass, kid. Because tonight, this mountain is a fucking volcano, and I'll fly this fucking Humvee if I have to," Horn said.
24. Ringgold stood on the 10-yard-wide watchtower platform atop the roof of the Harbor House Hotel in Galveston. Beside her stood Cornelius, Sousa, and Soprano. She had insisted on being outside the confines of her bunker to stand side by side with the troops sworn to protect this country. As a concession, Festa was inside the hotel, coordinating with a team of military officers and the representatives from Canada and Mexico. Festa would serve as the designated survivor, taking control of the defenses in a secure underground headquarters should something happen to Ringgold. In the middle of the platform, two armed communications officers had laptops and radios set up on a table behind a steel enclosure. Three snipers were situated in nearby watchtowers, and two-person teams manned M240s set up behind sandbags on the catwalks above the steel walls. A reinforced steel roof protected them from the light drizzle of rain. The fog had mostly lifted, and the storm was retreating, providing sight lines to both the I-45 bridge and the Gulf of Mexico. They had lost radar in the bat attack, rendering them otherwise blind. To watch for the First Fleet, Sousa had deployed 2 25-foot Coast Guard response boats. For the first time in her career serving her country, she carried an M4A1. She had spent every spare minute training with the weapon. She was not the only one holding a weapon like this in combat for the first time. Their defenses were filled with individuals who had been drafted days ago. Refugees, and even the injured, stood on the walls. Soprano was armed with a shotgun that he carried awkwardly. Ringgold wondered if he was more of a threat with it than without.
"The variants are closing in," Cornelius reported. "ETA 45 minutes.
"How far is Recon Sigma?" Ringgold asked.
"They're expected to arrive around the same time."
"That's cutting it too close.
We'll have to blow the bridge before the monsters arrive, whether they're here or not."
Ringgold could not imagine giving an order that would condemn some of her closest friends to almost certain death. But decisions like this were part of the burden she faced as president.
"Delay blowing the bridge as long as possible," she said. "But I would like—"
"Madam President, I'm sorry to interrupt," Sousa said. "I just heard from Festa. The First Fleet was reported just under 20 clicks out by one of our response boats."
Ringgold let her rifle fall on its strap and picked up her binoculars. She looked toward the east. Sheets of rain blocked any chance of seeing the distant fleet emerge over the horizon. "How many ships?" she asked.
"Without radar, hard to say, but the scout reported seeing the USS George Johnson and three other First Fleet ships. They were preparing to launch dozens of smaller boats filled with collaborators, variants, and chimeras."
"They're preparing for a full-on beach invasion," Cornelia said.
"Begin our aerial attack," Ringgold said. The general relayed the order, and moments later, the first few jets took off from the runway to their south. Other planes followed, military and slower civilian craft flying off with what little ordnance they had left. A distant flash of lightning cut through the sky. The minutes ticked by as the planes flew through the clearing storm toward the enemy fleet. The increasingly heavy thrum of her pulse sounded like war drums in her ears at the thought of what they would soon face. The USS George Johnson had been equipped with the best anti-aircraft weaponry the Allied States had left. She could only hope that the new gods did not know how to operate such advanced equipment. Unfortunately, she had also witnessed what had happened when the Allied States underestimated their enemy. Even if a fraction of their forces knew how to use the weapons, the ships could prove devastating to their forces.
"Our squadrons are almost in position," Sousa said.
A few moments later, one of the pilots came over the radio.
"Command Eagle One, approaching targets."
Ringgold could almost picture the ships cutting through the dark waves that the pilot must be seeing.
"Commencing bombing," said Eagle One.
"We are..."
The line suddenly went dead. Sousa stepped closer to the radio operator.
"The hell just happened?"
The operator shook his head.
"I think they were shot, sir."
Distant flashes of light strobed through the gray clouds over the horizon, like more lightning strikes behind the clouds. But there were far too many blasts for it to be from the storm.
"We're going down,"
another voice cried over the channel.
"Command, we're taking heavy fire. Engine failure. They hit. I can't hold out."
"All systems are failing. Target is still..."
More explosions bloomed across the gray horizon. Frantic voices filled the lines. Sousa picked up the radio.
"All pilots, this is command. Concentrate all weapons on the USS General Johnson. You can't let it get through."
"Command Eagle 3, a pilot said. "We've lost contact with a third of our units."
Sousa turned away from the radio, his jaw clenched, fingers curled into a fist.
"Damn it."
"It would have been even worse if these monsters really knew how to use that weaponry," Cornelia said. "All our aircraft and our base would be gone. We're lucky they must not have half the expertise our Navy did."
"Bombing still underway," Eagle 3 reported. "We're hitting it with everything we've got."
The rumble of the explosions barreled into Galveston like an unstoppable chorus of thunder.
"Command Eagle 6, another pilot said. "All ordnance deployed. Returning for reload."
"Eagle 6, can you confirm that all enemy anti-aircraft weapons were eliminated?" Sousa asked.
"Affirmative. All weaponry on the George Johnson is disabled. It's spitting fire, sir. She's not going to be floating much longer."
Cornelius raised a fist, and Sousa exhaled. Ringgold nodded at both of them, but the victory was short-lived. Eagle 6 reported two cruisers still had active anti-aircraft weapons. Ringgold watched the first of the surviving aircraft returning to Galveston. Calm chatter painted a grim picture of the damage to their beleaguered air force. She turned back to Soprano.
"Go confirm with Hernandez and Vance to see if there is anything the Mexican and Canadians can do to make their troops move faster," she said.
"Yes, Madam President," Soprano replied.
"New God's land units are now 20 minutes to the bridge according to seismic activity," Cornelia said.
"Sigma?" she asked.
"Still in route, just ahead of them."
Ringgold raised her binos back to the Gulf Coast. Planes were taking off into the screen of rain and clouds again. The first dark silhouettes of the First Fleet appeared over the choppy waters. She zoomed in, and while she couldn't make out all the details, the looming shape of the USS George Johnson was evident. Half its superstructure vented flames. The massive ship steamed ahead straight toward Galveston, but was listing precariously to its port side. Two cruisers barreled alongside it. Fingers of smoke rose from each vessel, and most of their decks seemed enveloped in fire.
Munitions exploded as the flames spread, shooting geysers of spreading debris into the air. The smaller crafts that Eagle Six and the Coast Guard response boats had spotted were churning alongside the bigger ships, struggling to maintain speed in the violent waves.
Unless the New Gods brought their own munitions, we know what was on those last ships for the anti-aircraft weapons, Sousa said. They can't have much left now, especially after all that damage.
I hope you're right, because we're sitting ducks, Ringgold said. Tracer fire spit into the sky from the cruisers. She watched in horror as the rounds tore into the lead aircrafts. A couple of the pilots managed to avoid the incoming fire, rolling away or diving underneath, but they disappeared in billows of white smoke and fire when missiles struck them. Only a few made it through with a combination of expert maneuvering and sheer luck. Blasts from the decks of the cruisers as the aircraft dropped their payloads. Part of the decks gave way, flames roaring out like enormous demons from the underworld. Crews on both ships started lowering lifeboats and another wave of smaller craft over the side. Some even jumped straight into the roiling waters. The guns on the USS George Johnson remained quiet, but she could still see the shapes of surviving enemy soldiers on the decks. Another wave of explosions rolled over the cruisers.
Command, Eagle Six, a pilot reported. We scored direct hits on the escort cruisers, coming in now to finish off any survivors on the George Johnson.
Another explosion rolled over the superstructure of the destroyer. Flames erupted from holes torn into the bent metal, but the ship continued to carve slowly through the water. That ship might be going down, but the battle wasn't over. Sirens wailed over the base once more. Soldiers raced for their battle stations along the walls, and spotlights raked the waters, illuminating the incoming boats. Ringgold could do nothing but watch them draw closer. A loud grating sound scraped over Galveston as the sinking George Johnson ground into the sand and rock offshore. Momentum carried it forward, kicking up waves, its ruptured keel slicing into the shallows until it finally lurched sideways, beached nearly 400 yards from the Galveston beach. The two burning and dying cruisers made it slightly further before they too succumbed to the same fate. Smaller motorboats and yachts chugged past them, advancing over the rolling waves, and crashed into sandbanks. From each of those smaller vessels, men and monsters jumped over the sides. Ringgold tried to keep track of the dozens upon dozens of creatures pouring off the boats and through the shallows. Tracer fire lanced from the walls. Low thuds resonated over the beach from grenades and mines. Geysers of sand, fire, and shredded body parts spewed into the air. A few helicopters they had on reserve made passes over the beach, spitting gunfire and launching rockets into the enemies stampeding over the sand. Collaborators returned fire with their own rockets. One streaked into a Blackhawk, erupting in a flash of light. The pilots managed to put the damaged bird down on the beach, but a pack of variants were on them before they could escape the wreckage.
"We've got more incoming," Cornelius said, pointing at the George Johnson.
While flames danced from the superstructure, a stream of smaller shapes flung themselves over the side into the water. Others raced down the ladders tracing the hull, leaping into rigid-hulled inflatable boats, lifeboats, and some of the other small craft nearby.
"There must be hundreds of creatures and collaborators on that ship," Cornelius said.
Ringgold roved her binos over the enemy soldiers, spotting squads of heavily armed chimeras with their cutlasses.
"Madam President, seismic activity indicates the rest of the New Gods land forces are poised to cross the bridge in less than 2 minutes," the comms officer said. "Recon Sigma is on the bridge now."
She turned her binos back to the bay. A lone Humvee raced across the lone bridge. Only about 500 yards behind them, the first rush of monsters followed, galloping across the asphalt. "Blow the bridges as soon as Sigma is across," she said. A moment later, explosions ripped down the bridge, red and orange balls of fire devouring the pillars holding it above the bay. Concrete gave way, falling in chunks, and almost as if in slow motion, the bridge began to collapse. Variants flailed as they plummeted with the debris. Soprano rushed back up the stairs to the platform, chest heaving.
"You have good news?" Ringgold asked.
Sousa and Cornelius both looked at Soprano.
"I'm sorry," he said. "The Canadian and Mexican forces are still hours from arrival. We're on our own for now."
Ringgold felt her stomach churn. The enemy had arrived by sea, air, and land. She had done everything she could to prepare, but still felt like it was not enough. The only thing left to do was fight. Raising her rifle to her shoulder, she readied herself for battle. Gunfire cracked across Los Alamos. Keeping low, Fitz advanced up a narrow street between two laboratory buildings, headed north with Team Ghost and a small array of chimeras and humans. It had been hell fighting through the streets and doing their best to stay concealed from the few guards left around the base. But they had unexpected help keeping the guards occupied. While most of the prisoners had followed them, a few distrusting chimeras and scared human prisoners had run off. Those fleeing prisoners were enough to draw many of the remaining enemy guards away. That distraction had helped Ghost, but it was a terrible choice for the prisoners. Screams rang out, some of them human, as the monsters found them.
"Should have stayed with us," Fitz said. "They chose their own deaths," Dohai said.
Fitz tried to understand the callous words. This was not the Dohai he knew. The Dohai who would do anything to save another person. But Fitz understood how trauma and PTSD could turn a good heart black. That kind of trauma could not be dealt with now. Instead, he focused back on the mission and took shelter behind a truck to sneak a glimpse at an intersection to the east. A friendly chimera had confirmed that just a few blocks in that direction was the command center for the new gods. Fitz surveyed the building. Camouflage netting covered two machine gun nests, and maybe a little over 10 chimeras perched along the roof. Collaborators were entrenched behind sandbags and aiming out of windows. Prowling thrall variants screeched and howled in the street. The smell of blood and sound of battle had them riled up. The only thing holding them back were the collars around their necks. Fitz turned to his team, telling them what he had seen.
"We've got the numbers," Dohai said. "Nearly 30 fallen chimeras still with us, and 30 human prisoners strong enough to fight."
"But less than half have firearms," Rico said. Corin clicked his claws together.
"But we have weapons."
"Still, it's suicide running headlong into that command building," Rico said. Fitz listened between a few more distant gunshots and the rattle of machine guns.
"If we don't do something quickly, they'll finish off the last of the fleeing prisoners, then find us," Fitz said. "The only reason we're still alive is because they sent damn near everything they had to Galveston."
All they needed to do was get to the Prophet, assuming he was even here. The command building was so close, but trying to sneak in with this army would not work. Fitz signaled to the chimera that had told them about the command center. The filthy half-man hunched down, reeking of body odor and festering wounds. "The front western entrance to this place is well guarded," Fitz said. "What's our best alternative?"
"There's a couple of secure doors on the north and south sides," the chimera replied.
"Those machine guns will cut us down before we can get close enough to get inside," Rico said.
"What about tunnels?" Fitz asked.
"The throne room was covered in webbing. We know the network goes inside."
The chimera looked uncertain.
"I don't know."
"I do," Esparza said. She was the first prisoner Dohai had released and was the strongest of the freed humans. "They forced me down there a few days ago to find soldiers who could join their ranks."
"Do you think you could get us to that tunnel?" Fitz asked.
Esparza nodded.
"We can't fit everyone through like that," Dohai said. "I've seen what happens to people in there. A little bit of panic and they'll run wild, get us all killed."
"Let me lead the chimeras," Corin said. "We can divide the forces. Humans with firearms can take the southern side of the building, and I will take my team to scale the walls on the north. That should give you enough distraction to sneak underground."
Fitz was quiet for a moment, listening to the distant sounds of collaborators and chimeras rounding up the other prisoners. He hated for so many to sacrifice their lives. But Corin was right. This was the most effective way to get inside.
"Let's do it," Fitz said.
He signaled to another human prisoner who had been a ranking officer before being captured in Vegas and told him to lead the humans. They divided up their ragtag army and relayed their plans. Fitz looked at Corrin one last time as the Chimera readied his forces.
Thank you, Corrin. You've done more than we ever could have asked. It's time to make the profit pay, Corrin said. Good luck, Master Sergeant Fitzpatrick, and to the rest of you.
Dohai reached out toward him. Corrin didn't seem to know what to do at first, but then he clenched Dohai's hand carefully in his own.
Good luck, brother, Dohai said.
Corrin held his grip for a moment, then nodded and led his troops away. At the same time, the human prisoners swarmed from their positions, cutting across the street and filtering between the other buildings. Those with weapons provided covering fire, allowing the army of liberated prisoners to spread out in combat intervals. The thrall monsters raced toward the human forces, and the machine guns behind them churned with the throaty growl of automatic fire.
Let's move, Fitz said.
Esparza took them back down the street, then cut across a block east toward an open road with three large holes. Red tendrils of webbing grew out of them. She pointed toward one, and they climbed inside a tunnel that reeked of carrion. Dohai took point, leading them through the darkened tunnels with his NVGs. They advanced at a run, and the sounds of battle outside grew muffled the deeper they went. Fitz's blades squished into the webbing and crunched over bones. They passed by dead humans and animals pasted on the walls. Esparza directed them through a few intersections until they reached a hole leading to the surface.
This is it, she whispered.
Fitz approached cautiously. Thick stalks of red webbing stretched upward. Sickly yellow light glowed from above. The smell here was worse than anywhere else in the tunnels. A few rumbling growls filtered in from the room above. Those were sounds Fitz was all too familiar with.
Masterminds.
From the floor of the tunnel, he could look straight up toward a ceiling covered in a spiderweb of red. This was definitely the auditorium they had seen on the video. The sounds of the battle raged outside, reminding him of the sacrifices made so they could get here. They had to hurry. The lives of all those outside in Los Alamos, and even those in Galveston, depended on it. He signaled for Esparza to back up, then beckoned Rico and Dohai. They all pulled M67 grenades from their tac vests and handed them to Dohai. He lobbed them up one by one through the hole into the throne room. A few surprised, raspy voices cried out, followed by three violent blasts. Chunks of webbing rained down into the tunnel.
Go! Fitz yelled.
Dohai took to the webbing and climbed up it with Esparza and Rico swinging themselves up after. Fitz was the last one up, entering the area between the stage and the seating. Smoke and the scent of burned flesh drifted through the air. Pieces of severed webbing squirmed across the floor. Fitz searched through the dissipating smoke for targets. As it cleared, he spotted the two giant masterminds on the stage, bleeding from shrapnel wounds in the folds of their pink flesh. He turned to scan the seating area, seeing a few dead chimeras sprawled around smoking sites where the chairs and webbing had been blown to scrap. Other beasts, closer to the back row of webbing-covered chairs, were recovering from the blasts. Two situated at the entrance of the room were already moving into firing positions. Fitz signaled for Dohai to flank them from the auditorium's north side, while Rico and Esparza dropped down behind the seats. He popped up and shot one of the advancing chimeras through its grotesque face. Then all hell broke loose, gunfire punching into the seats. Fitz ducked down and flattened his body. Using his elbows, he army-crawled to a new spot as bullets punched through the plastic seats behind him. Webbing and broken bits of the chairs sprayed over his body. Esparza got up to fire from an adjacent row, giving Rico and Fitz time to find another position. As soon as they were clear, Fitz gave Rico a nod. They rose to sight up their next targets, but the return gunfire had already stopped. A cry of agony roared across the enclosed space, and a final chimera thumped to the ground near the entrance.
Clear,
Dohai called. Dohai stood over the last chimera with blood dripping off his hatchet and knife. The team all turned to the stage where the two masterminds yanked on the webbing to call in reinforcements.
Prophet isn't here, Dohai said. Come on, we have to move, Fitz said.
Dohai led toward the doors, but they burst open before he could reach them. Four juveniles with collars around their necks lunged inside, growling and snapping. one barrel toward Dohai. He stumbled backward and fell, giving Fitz and the rest of the team clear firing lanes.
"Cover and fire!" Fitz shouted.
They unleashed a torrent of rounds into the armored skin of the beasts as the creatures bounded toward Dohai. Fitz aimed for their faces, seeking out their weakest spots. A well-placed shot to an eye killed the lead creature, tripping the others. Two of the remaining three went down in the gunfire, but the survivor pounced on Dohai. He jammed his knife right through the chin of the beast and deep into its skull. Fitz aimed at the entrance, spotting shapes in the darkness. Three or four muzzle flashes suddenly lit up the open doorway.
"Down!" he screamed.
Bullets plunged into the chairs and webbing around Teen Ghost. A round slammed into Esparza's shoulder, and she fell backward, crumpling against a chair. She pressed a hand against the wound. Blood gushed between her fingers. More rounds hammered their position. Fitz couldn't see their assailants or Dohai, but he could hear them. Another four juveniles rushed in screeching, and Dohai screamed back a blood-curdling war cry. Rico crawled past a few destroyed seats to another position. A monster suddenly leapt over the seats in front of her.
"Jenny!" Fitz yelled.
She swiveled onto her back, bringing her rifle up to parry the snapping teeth of the creature. Fitz tried to aim, but another juvenile swiped at him from the seats he was behind. The creature grabbed him by his collar and yanked him up, ripping his rifle strap with its claws and tossing him to the aisle. He hit the ground hard, but drew his holstered M9 with just enough time to fire at the beast as it lunged for him. Bullets smashed into its armor, but didn't kill the wretched thing. It grabbed his prosthetic blades and pulled him closer, right into biting distance as he fired into the armor of its neck and face.
"Stab!" came a gravelly voice.
The bleeding juvenile loosened its grip, whimpering and backing off. Fitz turned his gun on a chimera with a ragged cloak striding down the aisle holding a cutlass. A broken skull covered his face.
"Elijah."
The abomination that had killed Ace.
"Put your weapons down or you all die," Elijah said. "This is your one chance."
Fitz swallowed his anger and took a stolen moment to assess the situation while he kept his pistol trained on the skull mask. He couldn't see Dohai, but Esparza was down. Rico was in the grip of a juvenile, and six chimeras marched beside Elijah. They split up, advancing down the sides of the throne room.
"Put down your weapons or your little Rico dies," Elijah said. "The Prophet has chosen you. There is no need for you to waste your lives heedlessly."
The beast looked away from Fitz to Esparza.
"But not you, heretic."
At the snap of his claws, a juvenile leapt over a seat and ripped into her.
"No!"
Rico shouted. Fitz kept his gun aimed at Elijah as the monster tore Esparza apart, the sickening sounds of teeth on bone cutting through the air.
"Rico's next if you don't submit," Elijah said.
"Don't do it, Fitzy,"
Rico yelled. Saliva from the juvenile dripped onto her face. Fitz was about to lower his gun when Dohai leapt over the seats. With his hatchet and knife in hand, he ran for Elijah, screaming at the top of his lungs. A chimera tried to stop him, but Dohai whirled and sliced open the throat of the monster and then slammed his hatchet into the face of a second chimera. With only his knife left, he jumped onto a seat and then launched himself into the air toward Elijah. The chimera was caught off guard, and Dohai slammed into him, knocking him down. He brought the blade to Elijah's throat, but did not kill him.
"Back off!"
Dohai yelled to the other chimeras. The beasts throughout the room gave each other confused looks.
"Do it, or he dies,"
Dohai shouted.
"If you kill me, your friends die," Elijah growled. "I would readily give my life for the Prophet, but there is only one way out of this for you. Team Ghost joins the new gods, or the new gods feast on your flesh."
"I'd rather die than join," Rico said.
"Fitz," Dohai said, "tell me what to do."
Even if Dohai killed Elijah, they would all die in this throne room, and the Prophet would still be out there.
"You're outnumbered, and your pathetic forces are on the verge of complete defeat," Elijah said. "I'm giving you the only way you make it out of here alive. Join us." joined the Prophet.
Where's the Prophet? Fitz asked, trying to buy time.
In Galveston, leading our forces to victory.
Elijah chuckled under his mask despite the blade pressed against his throat.
It's over for your beloved country.
Dohai looked over his shoulder at Fitz, shock painted across his expression. Elijah took advantage of the mistake, grabbing him and tossing him aside. He rose to his feet with a cutlass in hand and angled it down at Dohai.
You weak, pathetic traitors, Elijah said. You should have surrendered when you had the chance.
25. The resounding thuds of explosives and the constant roar of gunfire filled the air. Beckham had his Shemagh scarf pulled up over his nose, but there was no keeping out the biting odor of smoke. Soaked from the sheeting rain, he and Ruckley were still on the catwalk stretching along the 10-foot-high steel panel wall surrounding the inner core of the base. Command and the hospital facilities were tucked away behind these walls, as was much of downtown Galveston. From the catwalk, they could see the bay and the bridge 4 miles to the southwest. Behind them, a platform led to a tower where Commander Jacobs was posted with his officers. It offered one of the best vantages on the island and was well protected by reinforced layers of wall topped with razor wire. Minutes ago, they had all watched Timothy and Horn arrive in their Humvee just before the soldiers guarding the bridge had blown it. Beckham had received radio confirmation that his friends had made it through the first sliding steel and razor wire gate where the Gulf Freeway met Galveston Island. Those outer walls and gates had taken too much damage in the bat attack to be defensible, so the soldiers assigned there had fallen back. They were now positioned on a second set of barricaded steel panel gates with 2 watchtowers, about 1 mile to the southwest, connected to the same inner core walls that Beckham and Ruckley were on. From what Beckham could tell, the second position was about to get hit hard. He lifted his binoculars to scan the choppy water of the bay. The pale flesh of variance broke the surface of the opaque waters as the beasts swam toward the shore. And it wasn't just monsters headed their direction. 2 Blackhawks descended to the other side of the bay to pick up stranded collaborators. Once they pulled back into the sky, they raced over the water toward where Horn and Timothy had taken refuge.
We've got incoming birds, Beckham said through the tower door to Jacobs. Do we have anything down there left to take them out?
Commander Jacobs stepped out and shook his head.
The aerial defenses were either destroyed or expended during the bat attack.
Shit, Ruckley muttered.
If they breach that, the variants coming in from the west will flood downtown and command, Jacobs said.
Then we need to stop those choppers, Beckham said.
Permission to take the M-72 Law rocket launchers and a Humvee. Jacobs thought on it a moment, but then nodded.
Take out those birds, but be careful, Captain.
Beckham started down a set of stairs with the weapons as Ruckley hobbled after him. He lost sight of the choppers when he reached the street under the wall. They loaded up into the Humvee and took off, Beckham navigating around a few stubborn fires and craters from the bat attacks. After driving with the pedal pressed against the floor, the inner gate with its 2 watchtowers came into view beyond a screen of smoke. He estimated he was only 1/4 mile from the inner gate when he saw the 2 choppers that had been racing across the bay again. This time, they had made it over where Horn and Timothy were supposed to be. Muzzle fire flashed from the birds as door gunners swept their machine guns over the walls and the 2 watchtowers beside the gate. With each passing second, the gout of gunfire over the defensive positions grew thicker, and Beckham feared soon it would be too late for Horn and Timothy. He couldn't lose them. Not now. Not after all they had been through.
You're not going to lose them. You're going to save them.
See if you can get Horn on the radio, Beckham said to Ruckley. Tell him to meet us at the bottom of the gate and look for our Humvee. On it, Ruckley said. While she tried to contact Horn, tracer fire pounded the first helicopter. The pilot banked hard to strafe the machine gun nest. The turning bird gave Beckham a clear view into the troop hold that was filled with chimeras. The beasts positioned in the open troop hold joined in with the door gunner to rain hell on the troops stationed in the towers and along the catwalks lining the walls inside the gate.
As both choppers began to lower over the gate, the Chimeras pulled out their cutlasses to prepare for hand-to-hand combat on the walls. Beckham drove faster, but then slammed the brakes around the next corner. The Humvee squealed to a stop behind the wreckage of an overturned semi-trailer.
"Out!" he shouted.
Ruckley opened the passenger side, and he jumped out and opened the back door to retrieve the launchers. As he grabbed one and threw the other over his back, Chimeras leapt from the two choppers, landing in the ranks of soldiers while swinging their swords. The crack of gunfire echoed over the cries of soldiers clashing with the Chimeras.
"Horn!" Beckham shouted. "Timothy!"
He scanned the soldiers now engaged in hand-to-hand combat across the walls and towers, but didn't see either of his friends.
"Look out!" Ruckley said.
One of the Blackhawks suddenly swooped low, forcing them to take cover behind the Humvee as the door gunner let loose a spray of fire. Bullets cracked against the hood and windshield, peppering the side of their vehicle. Beckham hunched down with Ruckley until the torrent was over. The bird flew away and strafed the wall again, tracer fire lancing out in a violent spray. Rounds punched into soldiers fleeing for cover. Dead bodies tumbled back off the catwalks and smacked against the ground with sickening thuds. The other Blackhawk was turning now, too, coming back in for a second attack.
"Fuck, we need to hurry," Beckham said. "We need a distraction."
"I'll do it," Ruckley said. "You take them out."
"How?"
"I'll drive, you fire," she said. Ruckley got into the driver's seat and fired up the engine. It groaned, but turned over, and she drove away. Beckham pulled out the arming pin of the Law rocket launcher, extended the weapon, and shouldered it. One of the choppers took Ruckley's bait and turned away from the wall, giving chase. He lost sight of her and focused on the bird. Beckham aimed, leading the cockpit, then squeezed the trigger bar. The rocket blazed from the tube. For a fleeting second, he feared he had missed, but the shriek of tearing metal sounded, followed by a low explosion. The rocket had punched right into the top of the troop hold. With the screech of protesting metal, the bird plummeted sideways before bursting into a fireball against the pavement. The second Blackhawk began to turn, but instead of going after Ruckley, it started toward his location.
"Oh, shit," Beckham said.
He ducked for cover behind the overturned trailer. Bullets pounded the sides, piercing the thin metal. He waited for the right moment before bolting away for the wreckage of a pickup truck with flames sputtering from under its hood. Beckham had hoped the smoke would obscure the pilot's vision, but the door gunner continued to pound his new location. Glass rained down on him as he flattened his body to the pavement and crawled under the back bumper. The front wheels both exploded. He had to move, or he was going to die, pinned under a burning truck. As he prepared to make his move, the bark of a second machine gun joined the fight. He clenched up, anticipating the fire, but the bullets weren't intended for him. He slid out from the truck and watched as the door gunner tumbled out the troop hold. The pilot pulled away, giving Beckham a perfect shot.
"Gotcha, motherfucker," he said, drawing himself up into a kneel and firing.
The rocket speared into the tail and sheared it off. The helicopter spun, tossing Chimeras out from the hold. Some survived the fall and tried to crawl away, but a Humvee swerved around a corner and slammed into them. Ruckley gave a thumbs-up sign out the window.
"Reed!" a deep voice called.
Beckham turned back to the other truck, his heart flipping when he saw it was Horn and Timothy. Singe marks and ash covered their ACUs, but they appeared uninjured.
"We have to help reinforce this gate," Horn said.
"Ruckley, keep the Humvee ready for us," Beckham said.
He followed Horn and Timothy back toward the semi-trailer where they had a clear view of the fighting on the catwalks and watchtowers. At least 10 Thrall variants had climbed the walls from the other side of the gate and were leaping onto the catwalks to join in the skirmish, fighting beside the remaining Chimeras. Most of the soldiers defending the gate appeared too young or too old to be fighting. As he ran, Beckham saw a boy no older than 14 standing next to a guy with a white beard who had to be pushing 70. The man held up a rifle to block a cutlass. The strike knocked him to his back on the catwalk. He shielded his face with a hand, and the Chimera cocked back his blade for the killing blow. Before Beckham could unsling his rifle, a burst of gunfire erased the creature's face.
"Nice shot," Horn said.
Timothy adjusted his aim and then took out a variant prowling toward a young soldier.
Half the variants were at the top of the walls, mixing in with the Allied soldiers on the platforms.
"Watch your zone of fire," Beckham shouted.
He shouldered his rifle and went to work, sending bullets tearing through a few beasts still climbing over the lips of the walls. Three of the Chimeras dropped to their knees and aimed toward Beckham in response to the incoming fire. Before they got off a round, Horn's M249 slung a fusillade of fire into their augmented bodies. Timothy helped Beckham pick off the rest of the monsters one by one. Their efforts were enough to regain control over the gate, and the surviving soldiers finished off the last few Chimeras. Horn jogged over to Beckham, and they shared a brief hug. After pulling away, Beckham pulled Timothy into a hug, too.
"Good timing, Captain," Timothy said.
"Good shooting."
The sounds of distant explosions and gunfire reminded him this was just one battle of many.
"Hold your positions and keep fighting,"
Beckham yelled to the surviving soldiers along the wall.
"This victory proves we can win."
Beckham led the way back to the Humvee.
"Good to see your mug," Horn said to Ruckley.
"You smell, like always," she replied. "But yeah, good to see you."
Timothy chuckled as they jumped into the vehicle and started to drive back toward the command post. As Ruckley steered around the wreckage of a Blackhawk, the radio crackled with a chilling report.
"Breach on the seaborne wall. Reinforce immediately."
"Fuck, we need to move," Beckham said.
"We got hostile choppers on the hospital now, too," another voice stated, "requesting immediate assistance."
Beckham tried calling back on the radio, dialing it in to reach Kate, but there was no answer.
"No, no, no,"
Beckham said, slamming his fists on the Humvee's dash. Horn put a hand on his shoulder.
"Ruckley, take us there now," Beckham said.
"You got it, Captain."
The Humvee sped down the debris-littered road. Beckham reloaded his rifle and tried to remain calm, but he struggled to contain his breathing.
"It's going to be okay," Timothy said. "We'll save her."
Beckham nodded, praying his young friend was right. Azrael leaned out of the passenger seat of the MH-6 Little Bird helicopter, taking in the scent of burned flesh and death. Corpses littered the street. Blood flowed freely. It was a shame. Many of these humans could have joined the new gods, but their ignorant and selfish leader had sacrificed them all in a futile attempt to preserve this pathetic country. Jen Ringgold was probably cowering deep underground, stubbornly hiding while she used her people as a shield of meat. He would find her, and she would pay for this foolishness. But first, he was headed to Dr. Kate Lovato and her team. He had used the remote sensors his scions had found in the Houston tunnels to track them down. It was a bit premature to be coming in this far to grab the scientist, but Azrael didn't want to give her a chance to escape. Besides, other choppers were depositing collaborators and variants around the island, and more of his forces flooded in from the breached walls on the eastern shore. 20 scions from his death squads were already waiting on the hospital rooftop. They had made quick work of the few guards there. The little bird touched down in the middle of the human corpses. Azrael strode out, the rotor wash kicking up his black cloak. One of the scions that had waited for his arrival knelt before him.
"Prophet, we are ready."
"Rise, Abaddon," Azrael said.
The scion stood again, facing him with golden eyes peering out behind a black mask.
"I want Kate and her team alive, but kill everyone else," Azrael said. "Have all our ground forces in the area secure the exits."
"Yes, Prophet," Abaddon said.
Abaddon turned and led the death squads into the building, rushing down the stairs. From the pre-war schematics of the hospital, Azrael knew the clinical laboratory was on the second floor. That would be the most logical place for the science team to have set up their labs. As Azrael followed his warriors into the building, he heard the cries of the injured. These helpless, weak humans would serve no purpose other than to feed his army. He wasn't sure why anyone would want to protect these breathing corpses, but a group of soldiers had set up a barricade of patient examination beds just inside the hall on the third floor.
"Kill them,"
Azrael said. A group of four scions led by Abaddon scaled the wall, their claws finding purchase just like their variant brothers. They maneuvered above the barricade and dropped behind the beds.
Agonized screams and the ripping of flesh echoed through the hallway. When those last dying moans grew silent, the four scions emerged. Blood dripped from their maws and talons. Azrael continued the trek down the hallway to a doorway that would take them to the second floor. As he passed patients, some of his forces peeled off to kill and feed. Azrael had given these humans all a chance to submit, a chance to accept his mercy. But Ringgold had refused, so he and his talented hunters showed them no quarter. Some humans tried to crawl or scramble away, one of them running in front of Azrael. He reached out and grabbed the young man by his throat, lifting him up and crushing his windpipe. Then he tossed the limp body away. His forces dominated any stubborn heretics foolish enough to fight them in the enclosed space, lashing out with their rifles and cutlasses when the skirmishes devolved into hand-to-hand combat. They churned through the facility like a wildfire, devouring dry fields of grass. A final group of soldiers had constructed another barricade in front of what looked to be the clinical laboratory. Abaddon waved his cutlass toward them, and the scions charged. Bullets cut into their ranks, dropping a few, but the meat of the scion ranks crashed into the barricade. Patient beds tumbled, chairs splintered and broke. Human soldiers fell back, screaming, as the scions pounced on them. Azrael strode past them as his loyal followers ripped their flesh. His stomach growled hungrily as blood spilled over the floor. But his desire to find the infamous Kate Lovato exceeded his appetite. He was close now. As he stepped into the doorway, he spotted a group of scientists huddling in the back of the lab. Azrael motioned for his soldiers. Together, they broke through the windows with their swords and rifles. The scions flooded in and surrounded the group. One of them was standing. To no surprise, it was exactly the person he had come here to see.
"Dr. Kate Lovato," he said. "I've waited a long time to meet you."
"And I you, Dr. Charles Morgan," she said.
"That name is no longer mine. Call me Azrael."
"I'll call you a monster, because that's what you are." She spat at him, hitting him in the face. One of his scions grabbed her by an arm, his claws cutting through her white coat and drawing blood. She let out a surprised cry of pain. Azrael roared and swung his cutlass right across the neck of the soldier. The scion let go of Kate, pressing his fingers against the flap of bleeding flesh.
"I told you, no harm comes to her," Azrael shouted.
The creature writhed as blood poured around his claws, and Abaddon dragged the disobedient soldier away. "You don't have to do this," Kate said. "I know you were once a scientist who wanted to help humanity."
"I am helping," Azrael replied. "I offered mankind a way to evolve."
"This isn't evolution, it's madness."
"Ironic, considering you're responsible for what you see before you."
Azrael gestured toward his scions.
"It was your bioweapon that altered my cure. It created the scions and the variants. And now you are trying to fight us, to make us extinct. Why do our lives not matter?"
"Because you're trying to destroy all of us," Kate said. "You preach about saving humanity, but you're destroying it, Dr. Morgan."
"That is not my name."
In a fit of anger, he shoved her. Her head hit the wall with a heavy thud, and she collapsed. A woman with dreadlocks yelled out in surprise, bending to help.
"It's okay, Sammy," Kate said to the other woman.
To Azrael's surprise, Kate pushed herself back to her feet, unaided.
"I'm trying to elevate humanity," Azrael growled.
Kate rubbed the back of her head.
"You cannot elevate humanity by turning us all into monsters or enslaving us."
"I gave you a choice. All of you."
"A choice of slavery or death, like you gave them?"
She indicated the scions with a wave of her hand.
"How many of your people are sacrificing their lives needlessly to satisfy some grudge you've carried for over a decade?"
She turned to his scions, appealing to them.
"This prophet of yours is nothing but a fraud.
He's using you because he's angry about what happened to him, not because he's ushering in some great future.
A couple of the soldiers looked at Azrael, almost as if they were uncertain who to believe. The others growled at Kate.
"Ignore the heretic,"
Azrael said as calmly as he could. She was no longer worth his time. He lunged forward and grabbed Sammy this time.
"You care about this woman, don't you?"
Kate said nothing. Azrael picked Sammy up by the neck. She kicked her legs and pulled at his fingers, her mouth opening, trying to suck down air that she couldn't breathe.
"Tell me where President Ringgold is,"
Azrael said. Kate held up a hand. "Please let her go." Azrael tightened his grip, watching his victim turn pale.
"Tell me, or I will crush her windpipe," he said.
Kate looked conflicted, her eyes flicking between him and Sammy.
"All I want is to talk directly to your president," Azrael said. "If you don't tell me, I will slaughter every living soul until I meet her. You'll be helping your people by telling me exactly where to go."
Sammy gasped for air, blinking.
"Tell me where the president is hiding now," he yelled.
Gunfire cut him off, the sound ringing out from the hallway. He heard the screams of humans, chimeras, and variants, another battle raging in the hospital.
"Tell me,"
he roared. Sammy's eyes were bulging now.
"Let her go,"
a man yelled.
"Ron, stop,"
Kate said. Ron rushed Azrael, his hand outstretched for Sammy. Before he could even touch her, Abaddon's cutlass came down, separating the man's head from his torso.
"Run!"
another woman in a white coat yelled. Sammy's movements became weaker and slower.
"Is no one going to tell me?"
he asked. The other woman in the white coat finally broke, tears streaming down her face.
"They're at the Harbor House Hotel. Please let her go."
Azrael tossed Sammy at the woman. More gunfire erupted down the hall, closer now.
"Someone's broken through our lines outside,"
one of the Scions said, his voice crackling.
"Our loyalists said it looks like Reed Beckham was with them."
Azrael snarled. While he yearned to wait here and face Captain Reed Beckham, Master Sergeant Fitzpatrick, and all those other foolish traitors to make them pay for the pain they had caused, there was one other person more important to him, President Jan Ringgold.
"Secure these prisoners,"
Azrael said to his soldiers. They tied the science team up in cables and ropes from their packs.
"Stay here with one death squad,"
Azrael said to Abaddon.
"If I have learned anything about Beckham, it's that he would fight through hell to see his pathetic wife. Take Reed, Ghost, or anyone else who shows up here alive if possible. If they cannot be taken alive, then destroy them."
"Yes, Prophet,"
Abaddon replied. Azrael turned to leave, but hesitated.
"Do not fail me," he said.
His gaze moved to Kate.
"I'll see you soon, Doctor," he said.
26. Gunfire echoed through the hall. Timothy had not stopped firing and running through the hospital since they had taken out a squad of chimeras guarding one of the entrances. He pushed through a second-floor corridor filled with dead beasts. Beckham and Horn were far ahead, firing and taking down guards, while Timothy helped Ruckley limp through the destruction. All around them, disemboweled patients littered the hallways, some of them missing limbs. His mind raced, wondering how the civilians were faring as the enemy tore through Galveston. Were Tasha, Jenny, Javier, and the dogs safe? Horn and Beckham had to be worried sick, but they weren't showing it. Both men were machines, killing with calculated precision and moving past the macabre scenes without flinching. All Timothy could do was take things one at a time. Advance to this corner, clear a hallway. Each time his vision narrowed to the corridor and enemies before him. That mentality had gotten them through the hostile forces so far. They reached another section of hallway choked with the bodies of soldiers, patients, and hospital staff who had given their lives. The smell of death and cordite hung heavy in the air as the team advanced.
"Almost there," Beckham said. "Just one more turn on our left."
Ruckley hobbled after him, carrying her M9. They slowed when they approached the next corner. Beckham had told them the lab doors were situated at a T-intersection. Horn peered around the edge, then motioned that he had seen two hostiles. Timothy's heart sank. Had they already killed the science team? He looked toward Beckham, but the experienced operator's face was hard as steel. Beckham appeared to be considering their next moves. He motioned for Horn and Timothy to go down another hallway and loop back around so they could come at the lab from a different side, flanking the sentries. Beckham and Ruckley would stay behind, taking the sentries head-on, keeping their attention, while Horn and Timothy took them out. Timothy nodded and ran down another set of halls. More bodies lined the corridors, and he tried not to let his eyes linger on all those who had lost their lives down here.
Focus, Timothy thought again.
He remembered what Horn had told him before. Tomorrow they would mourn the dead. Today they would fight to save the living. He and Horn made it all the way around to the other side of the laboratory wing. They could see the sides of the two sentry chimeras facing straight down the hallway where Ruckley and Beckham were. Broken glass covered the hallway. Timothy kept his rifle shouldered and took cover behind a sideways chair, providing him just enough shelter to stay out of sight. The chimeras began to sniff the air, their nostrils pointed up. Beckham and Ruckley opened fire, and both creatures dove for cover, right into Timothy and Horn's sights. They blasted the armored beasts, killing them instantly.
"Let's go," Horn said.
Timothy leapt over the busted chair and followed Horn. They jumped through the broken windows into the lab and then ducked behind the cover of the massive lab benches. Beckham and Ruckley continued firing toward the lab entrance from the hall. Timothy leaned around a bench, seeing a pair of chimeras standing over the scientists and engineers who had been working here. Timothy shifted to another position to see how many other chimeras were in the room. As he did, a beast in a black mask leapt over the lab bench, knocking aside computers and plastic vials. He landed hard on top of Horn and slammed his head into the ground. Timothy leveled his rifle, but the half-man dodged past the burst of gunfire as it scrambled on all fours, slamming his shoulder into Timothy's face. The impact knocked Timothy back, his vision blurring. He felt clawed fingers tighten around his neck and blink to see golden eyes staring at him.
"Never thought I would see you again," the creature growled.
The crackling voice sounded vaguely familiar. The beast picked Timothy up and slammed him against a lab bench. Panicked cries rang out from the scientists and engineers. Timothy tried to pull his knife, but the chimera grabbed his hand, pinning him on his back to the bench. Horn was still struggling to stand, his head rolling on his shoulder. Other chimeras were firing into the hallway, keeping Beckham and Ruckley back. The chimera leaned closer.
"Do you not recognize me?" he snarled.
He pulled back his mask. His grayish flesh was covered in scars, and his nose was barely existent. But if Timothy squinted through his blurred vision, he could almost see the man, the collaborator, that this chimera had once been.
"How about now?" the chimera asked.
Timothy tried to talk, but he was too stunned.
"I am Abaddon," the chimera said.
He pushed down on Timothy's sternum.
"But before I was chosen, I was called Nick."
Timothy felt something pop in his chest. His vision went hazy, and his heart raced.
"You destroyed my family," Nick said. "Now I'm going to make you suffer agony like you've never known."
The gunfire in the hall continued in deafening bursts. Horn was starting to push himself upright, but the big operator looked dizzy, like he had suffered a traumatic concussion.
"Do you know how that feels?" Nick asked, leaning down toward Timothy.
He spit in his face.
"Losing everything."
Timothy struggled to breathe, but he managed a nod. He pictured